Good morning. This is the LCC Subcommittee on Data Practices. And for the record, this is October 10th, 2019. And we will start by approving the minutes of our last meeting. Do I have a motion for approval? Senator Newman moves the adoption of the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Today we have an agenda of two major subjects. One is the continuation of our discussion and approval of the legislation that was originally created by Senator Dibble in the Senate. Senator, did you have an author in the House that we could give a little credit to? The man standing beside me, is that who you're talking about? That'd be Representative Lesch. All right. Well, we're going to continue this discussion. As you might recall, we had a fairly good discussion about the legislation that was before us last meeting. There were a number of issues that surfaced. We really have them narrowed down to about three or very possibly four. And I think what I'm going to do is pass this on to Ms. Priya and see if she could give us just a quick review and then focus on the issues that were kind of hanging us up last time and the suggested language we have before us.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you, SC5562-5, is substantively similar to the bill you saw at the previous hearing, and there is a detailed summary in your packet for your reference. I'll go through the four changes that were made directly in response to comments from members of this committee. So the first changes are on page 2, line 9. There is now a definition of terrorist attack, and it references a definition currently in statute, and this was an issue raised by Senator Newman. On the same page, line 29, for clause 8, there's now been a phrase added, over a public area. I believe Representative Scott may have raised this issue, as well as perhaps one or two other members, that the public relations purpose didn't necessarily have confining language. So this was added so that officer training and public relations purposes must be conducted in a public area. Page 4, lines 7 through 9. This is subdivision 8, and there was a great deal of discussion about the remedies provision at the previous hearing of this subcommittee, specifically with regard to the phrase appropriate relief. So this subdivision has been reworded, and that phrase has been eliminated and replaced with in addition to any other remedies provided by law. So that would be anything provided either by statute or by common law, as well as a civil action under this bill for any violation of the provisions in this new section, as well as Chapter 13 remedies. And then the last change was on the same page at line 12. The phrase including requests for use from government entities has been added, and this was in response to a Senator Newman concern about an exception that exists on page 3, lines 1 through 3, where a government entity makes a request to law enforcement for UAV use, and there was some concern that there wasn't enough guidance about how that request would be made. And so this directs law enforcement to create a written policy that specifically provides that guidance, so it leaves it to the discretion of law enforcement. And those are all the changes that have been made.
All right. Thank you. And Priya, I mentioned your name is Miss Priya. It's Miss Premal. Sorry about that. One background information, just so everyone knows this. Our discussion last meeting, we were reviewing the bill as was fully negotiated by stakeholders, and they had all contributed. The comments and the issues that were raised by research just now were ones that were raised by our members on this committee for either trying to address a lack of specificity or some other reason. I'll open it up for discussion. Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the changes. I think they're good. The one I still have concern about is subdivision 3, number 9. So it starts on line 3.1 to 3.3. So I think it's just redundant that if the Parks Department wants to use the drone, that they have to put it in writing. When we also have documentation required for each use, and then we also have the annual report. I just think we keep putting things on our local partners, and it's redundant in this policy. So I would hope we could get rid of number 9, as stated in the amendment here. And then I actually have something else I just kind of wanted to throw out there and add. I feel this way about medical examiner's offices too, is that it would be nice if this annual report would have a public hearing at the county board. You receive this information, it's put in a county board packet, and then sometimes they talk about it, sometimes they don't, and it complies with the law. But this would give people the opportunity to come before the county board and say, hey, man, we really don't like that you're using it for this, you know, this purpose, or do you really need to use it for that? So I would ask that we change it to remove that subdivision 9 there and actually add that it has a public hearing at the governing agency. So if it's the city of Minneapolis, it's the city of Minneapolis. If it's Hennepin County, it's Hennepin County, if the sheriff has it. So that's my first request, is that I would hope we could get consensus to adjust that. The second one, do these plans have to be approved prior to purchase of and operation of the use of the drone? Doesn't say when it has to be approved. Like, we could have people not having a written policy like this now as in depth as we're asking, and we understand they're going to have to take some time to update their policies. But before a county or a city or the state, for that matter, I guess, would authorize expenditure of one of these devices, is that the requirement that this be approved first? I guess I don't see that. Maybe I'm. Somebody wants to draw my attention to it, but I've read this a couple times. I didn't see it.
Ms. Premal?
Mr. Chair and members, so to your second point, Senator Bingham, page 3, lines 6.7, state that the governing body overseeing the law enforcement agency must approve the agency's acquisition of a UAV.
So I get that part, but it doesn't say, and that's, to approve an expenditure, they have to do that anyway. What I'm asking is, do they have to approve the plan prior to approving the acquisition of a UAV?
You're basically asking, Senator Bigham, what comes first, the
yes.
chicken or the egg?
Yes, thank you.
And I don't know if there's any one better answer than another, to tell you the truth. If a political subdivision is anticipating the purchase of a drone, upon acquisition of the drone, they definitely would need to have it if they are intending on using it. And I'm assuming that they aren't going to buy it unless they assume to use it. So they should have it by then. I don't know if it is necessary to have it one ahead of the other. But okay. Perhaps... upon acquisition of a drone, written policies must be in place. Yep. Something to that effect.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just think if I picked it up, probably somebody else much smarter than myself would pick it up, like a lawyer. And so they may want clarification on that.
You're assuming a lawyer is smarter than you are, Senator Bingham?
That would know the law better than I. So
Again, you're assuming?
Yeah. I think that I think we should at least clarify that.
All right.
Because you don't want to expend the money and then have to wait a year to get a policy approved, which I know is up to the local government. But I just think that's...
Okay. Is there any... Senator or Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just visiting with House Research, and on line 4.10 through 4.13, it says the chief officer of every state and local law enforcement agency that uses or plans to use the UAV must establish and enforce a written policy on its use. So it looks like...
Mr. Chair, Senator Bingham. Senator Bingham, the way I read it on line 4.11 is that when an agency uses or plans to use would be a prior event, and I would think it would cover in both cases, either or. If there's a better way to write it, sure. I don't know. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bingham, I think it's worthwhile to remember the only time when this language matters, and that's when it comes up for some kind of enforcement action. So a panel, whether it's an administrative law judge or a district court judge, is going to review this in the context of whether they had the policy. And if they had the policy at the time of the infraction, they're covered. If they did not, then they're not covered. So I don't think it really matters when they did it. They're going to be held accountable for having the policy when they get their hands caught in the gears on it, and that's why they should do one as soon as possible.
Any other discussion? Senator Newman?
Mr. Chair, I just indicate that in general, I do like the changes that have been made. I want to thank staff for doing that, specifically as to the discussion regarding Subdivision 9. I would agree with Representative Lesh as to his last comments. And I do believe that the language where it indicates an agency is using or planning to use the UAV does cover the questions that have arisen around Subdivision 9.
Any other discussion? Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I make the motion that we accept the changes as presented.
Motion is before us that the provision known as SC5562-5, the bill is recommended to pass and be recommended to advance to the legislature as a recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. We'll now move on to the next order of business, and that's a discussion of what cloud data is and some suggestions by the organization Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. This is language that they would like us to consider. We're not going to be making any formal decision on it. This is an informational presentation at this time. something for us to consider in the near future, even perhaps as early as the next meeting we meet at. We have Matt Ealing from Minkoji here, and then we'll follow up with Stacy Christensen from our data practice office here in the state. Mr. Ealing, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
Mr. Ealing.
Certainly.
Members, we have a recommendation outlined in your packets of two options that Mr. Ealing would like us to consider for the use of data and how we may use the infrastructure known as the cloud and what precautions we should take, as well as references to how that affects our existing definitions of what data privacy and other data classifications are and how it's affected by the cloud if we so used that entity. Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We would like to thank yourself and Representative Lesch for the opportunity to provide some options for statutory language pertaining to the use of cloud data by the government and how it interacts with the state's Data Practices Act. As I noted last month, dealing with the district court opinion in the Amazon case, which caused problems that I detailed in September, would either take further litigation to resolve or a statutory change confirming that cloud-based data used by the government is, in fact, government data. And in terms of the latter, we've brought forward a couple of different options. These are still in process. They're not perfect, but they showcase a more narrow, tailored option and a broader option for the discussion of this committee. The first option aims to describe computer-based processes that we now call cloud data, and it also aims to define when those processes result in government data under Chapter 13, essentially establishing a sub-definition of government data. Option one begins by creating a new section in Chapter 13. Subdivision one of that section defines cloud data as data stored on a computer, computer network, or similar that is possessed, controlled, or owned by a third party and is accessible to a government entity through communications technology, an internet connection, or other electronic process. Subdivision one also defines a right of access as one that is established by an express or implied contract, an agreement between a third party and the government entity, or a consensual act undertaken by a third party that permits data to be accessible to a designated government entity. So while contractual agreements provide one trigger for government access to cloud data, there are many other informal activities involving government data and cloud data that go on a daily basis that need to be captured as well. For instance, in the Amazon case, a third party that stored data on a Box file sharing account then shared that data with the government through a very informal means. It simply sent them a digital link that permitted a state agency to log in and access the data. So moving on to subdivision two, that states that if a government entity has a right of access to cloud data, it has then collected, received, and or maintained government data. And it's this right of access that is the criterion for making cloud data, government data. The third subdivision serves an important function by indicating that while something called cloud data is defined by this new section, that section does not provide an exclusive definition of the receipt, maintenance, or collection of electronic or computer-based data under Chapter 13. And as computer-based processes are always developing and changing, it's important that this section not be interpreted as defining the only way that the government would interact with computer-based data. This essentially defines one way in which the government interacts with computer-based data. So this approach gets at the cloud data issue, but it does so in a way that's slightly unusual from a structural standpoint within Chapter 13. Chapter 13 has, for 40 years now, had a very broad definition of government data, so the establishment of sub-definitions has not really been necessary. The bulk of Chapter 13 classifies data as opposed to establishes sub-definitions of what is government data. If you look at case law involving and interpreting government data, there are very, very few cases up to this point that have said that a piece of government data that the government interacts with is not government data. So option one is one way to get at establishing a sub-definition, but there may be other ways, and there may be other ways and other places within Chapter 13 to place this right of access concept. And we've looked to that language because if you look at some other state and federal cases that deal with cloud data issues, they have developed this right of access concept as the trigger for their public records laws and statutes to apply to third-party data being used by the government in a cloud format. So option two goes in a slightly different direction. Rather than narrowly defining something called cloud data, this approach states that when a government entity uses the computing capabilities of third-party, broadly defined, that data, the data that is received or otherwise captured through the government's use of those computing services is government data. As with option one, this is rough language. It's not perfect, but it shows what a broader possibility would look like as opposed to a more narrowly tailored approach. So we are open to having more discussions about this. There are doubtlessly other ways to get at this issue. We would stress that this is a very, very important issue to tackle right now. In the wake of this Amazon case, it really calls into question some fundamental assumptions about when the public has access to government information, including using practices that are in common use right now, such as accessing Gmail, which is entirely hosted on third-party servers, never hosted on government servers, but used by many government entities on a daily basis. So I'd be happy to take any questions, and I would note that any other parties that wish to discuss this with us, we are open to more discussion.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's more of a comment than it is a question. When looking at this, specifically subdivision 2, access to cloud data by government entity, the thing that comes to my mind is we just want to be sure that given the nature, I think the example we saw in the last commission meeting here was the invites for cloud computing many times are to individuals, to individual email addresses, and those individual email addresses could be a government email address or it could be a private email address. So the thing that crosses my mind when I read access by government entity, I want to make sure that there's a definition that's inclusive of anybody acting on behalf of that government entity, because the invites are going to come to individuals, whether they be employees or contractors. So just food for thought. Thank you.
Representative Bowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question, too, about subdivision 2. So I work in a public law office, and we use Westlaw for our research. So we contract with a third party in order to be able to use those research functions. And the way I'm reading this is that would cover anything I'm searching for on Westlaw. Now, I might have work product and attorney-client privilege and all of that, but it seems a little too broad, and I'm afraid we're encompassing some of those kinds of scenarios into this language.
Representative Mueller, a reaction to that. That has come up from other parties we've talked to. The interesting thing about our public records laws is that they not only encompass Chapter 13, which has set out a very broad definition of government data. Those of us who have made many data requests have seen the government provide, as in response to various requests, that kind of information. If they have searched for a law reviewed article that's pertinent to the requested language, sometimes that gets provided. But there is a real concern about scope, and I would direct people to also understand that public records are also bounded and impacted by Chapter 138, which is our records retention statute. So while something may be government data, if there's not a requirement within Chapter 138 that it be retained, then there is no legal requirement to turn it over in response to a public records request, for instance. So I think looking at the interaction of those two statutes is important going forward in this matter also.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in reaction to Representative Mueller's comments, it definitely a legitimate concern. The thing that I stress when having these conversations of this nature is what we're discussing is the digital space, the digital realm. But there's a long precedent of these exact same actions in the physical realm. So the question would become, Westlaw, with their content, so 20 years ago or pre-cloud or pre-internet, with their proprietary information being available via the internet, how was it done? It would have been books, I would think, of some nature, printed text. And so then what precedent or law or statute exists that would prevent what we're discussing here for their proprietary information in text form from being accessible or falling inclusive into this? And so I just say that because it helps us to wrap our mind around this fuzzy, cloudy area we're discussing. Mm-hmm. And bringing it back to, it's the exact same principle, the mechanisms in the physical realm. We're just going to carry them forward now into the digital space. And much of the limitations and precedent should carry forward as well. At least that's the intent.
Any other discussion? Mr. Ealing, the importance that we're having this discussion is that more and more often we are getting requests, and the issue of data retention is surfacing for political subdivisions. And the argument back is it costs too much money by political subdivisions, and the storage capability is awkward at times if a small entity were to conduct that storage facility on its own. So the cloud is becoming kind of a default location where they can store that, and it's important for us to have this discussion because the cloud seems like it's perhaps the only option to hold that information for those type of entities that can't afford, just due to scale, that they couldn't afford it any other way. As I look at your proposal, at least in option one, I'm looking for the location where a private party or a private entity could gain access via the cloud for information that might be stored there pending the appropriate data classification. Does this allow a private person to go to the cloud and pull that information up, or would they have to go through some other circuitous route through the political subdivision to gain that information? Could you point that out to me?
Sure. Senator Limmer, the intent of this language in option one is to provide a sub-definition of what is government data. So if a party had to previously go to a local government entity to get school board records, let's say school board records maintained in a paper file or even maintained on an electronic computer database housed within the school board facility, then they'd have to go to that local government entity to get it. In the event that that information is moved to a third-party storage unit, electronic storage unit off-site, they would still have to go to the local government entity to get it. Now, the problem with the Amazon case is that if that data, the school board records, are maintained by the school board entity, it's previously understood that whatever format it's maintained in or wherever the location is, it's accessible to the requester if it's public information. The Amazon case calls into question it starts to parse out who is holding the data and therefore who can access the data, and that's the problem we're trying to get around here.
The way I look at it, whenever I look at data issues, I try to simplify it in my own mind. And we're just relying on a different file box to hold the information for a longer period of time for the purposes of either posterity or the need for the public to have access, no matter what the time factor is. We have that capability now to do that. The cloud is only a bigger file box that we can have offsite instead of going down the hall and opening the local file box down the hall for, let's say, a township or a small school district. And I think that at least helps me understand what we're trying to rely on. The The one reference here under a right of access is established by in paragraph 2, a consensual act undertaken by a third party. Can you explain how that works?
Certainly.
Who are the consensual parties, and then who is the third party?
Certainly. The intent of those two pieces of language, the one you're referring to that deals with the consensual act, is a consensual act undertaken by a third party who is not a government entity. So in order to narrow the possible scope of how this language reads, the third party would have to expressly provide either the data or a right of access to the data to the government entity. So that's one possibility for triggering a right of access. The other possibility is that there's a formal contract or an implied contract or an agreement between the government entity and the third party they're using to store the data. So those are the two triggers to the right of access as this language is written.
Let me try and re-clarify my question. On the third party, are you saying that that third party needs to have some contractual relationship in order to gain access? Or would their request have to be recorded?
Senator Limmer, under the right of access language, there is the possibility that it would require a contract or an agreement, but it's not exclusively a contract or agreement. That's why there's this second sentence dealing with this consensual act, which would not require contractual terms, but could simply be the third party decides to send the data or decides to provide access to the government entity. And that's really the issue that we saw in the Amazon case with the box data that was being maintained. They just simply sent a link to Deed and said, here is how you access this data. Now, again, that would be collection, create a receipt and maintenance of data from the way we look at it. And so this simply is a sub-definition that covers that kind of activity, making sure it is considered to be government data that's received, collected, or maintained.
A better way to maybe understand it is I know that our motor vehicle department has all the records of everyone who has a driver license in the car, vehicle that gets a license plate or a registration. That information is not available to any private citizen. That's considered private, but we do make exception for certain businesses, such as car manufacturers, that would require information like that to inform an owner of a specific vehicle if they have a recall that might endanger their life if it wasn't taken care of. And so is that what you're trying to, what a third party may be under contract versus the private citizen that might gain other access or access to other information that would be more available for the general public?
Senator Limmer, if a private citizen wanted to gain access to this information in the cloud, they would have to go through a government entity, and then the information that they're trying to get is then subject to Chapter 13's data classifications, which doesn't make it all public. It makes portions public that are public under law. So there are other areas, as you've noted, where there are private data classifications or confidential data classifications that they would not be able to access. And so that's all governed by the Chapter 13 classification structure.
Is there any other discussion? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you, under the right of access, where it speaks to an express or implied contract or agreement, I understand express contracts, but could you give us a couple of examples of an implied contract or agreement that would allow a third party access?
Certainly. Senator Newman, an implied contract under Minnesota case law is a contract that's not in a written form, but it's created through the actions of the parties, and it's often defined by a fact finder, defined by a judge in reviewing whether those actions have the necessary elements of a contract to establish a contract. So we thought it, for the purposes of defining the possibilities of what an agreement or contract could look like, we would include express and implied contracts, as well as agreements, which would be something short of a contract where there's no consideration, for instance.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you. I do understand the elements of an implied contract. What I'm asking is specifically as to this option, what type of circumstances would exist for an implied contract to arise which would give the third party access to the documents or to the data? That's an express contract I would think would be appropriate. I'm questioning whether or not an implied contract to this specific proposal would be appropriate, and I'm asking for if you could provide me with an example to help me understand why an implied contract may be appropriate.
Certainly. The language, and again, this is not final language, but this is to get at the idea that there are circumstances, like in the Amazon bid case, that would not fit under a formal contractual arrangement, where a third party and a government entity have been conducting acts whereby they're sharing data that is pertinent to the government's functioning, and the public would have a right of access to that data if it was government data. So say a third party is housing data for a government entity or providing data to a government entity, and they've been conducting those activities without a formal contract, an implied contract could be inferred from their conduct. And so that's why that's been discussed here as an option.
Senator Newman.
Yeah, members, I would just ask that you think about the issue of an implied contract versus an express contract. Again, I understand the implied contract and its elements. I'm simply questioning whether or not it would be appropriate to allow access by implication rather than an express agreement.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I'm listening to the discussion, the hypothetical scenario that I encounter many times in my role in the private sector is where I'm working in my capacity and I bring in representatives of third party that might help us with some technology needs that we have. And as part of this discussion, maybe there's a PowerPoint presentation, maybe there's a proposal, maybe there's more information needed that isn't going to be exchanged at that time. At the conclusion of that meeting, there'd be something to the effect of, hey, we'll make a Dropbox available for you so you can upload additional information that would help us as part of this discussion, or for whatever case, or we're going to put this PowerPoint presentation up in a Dropbox so that you can access after this presentation. Okay, so in that conversation, no contract has taken place. And in this case, what was referenced, Amazon, so there's an application, there's a series of other information, and then it was simply a digital space out on the cloud and the web was made available to upload this application. But there's no formal contract that exists. So I think what's attempting to be captured here is that scenario, that there's an exchange of information and a relationship exists absent a formal contract, as we would traditionally think. And so if the implied contract isn't the best verbiage, we need to find another way to capture that making data available or the space available to put data and then capture what we're trying to do here, which is that is inclusive of being accessible to those that are requesting it.
Any further discussion? I've got a mind fog. Senator Clausen, wow.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. It's only been 8 years and we sat right behind you for 4 years. But that's okay.
Thanks for rubbing it in.
question about subdivision two, access to cloud data by government entity. Could you clarify that a little bit more? I look at the word if, and I'm just wondering why that's there, and maybe just a little bit more about intent of that and clarifying what actually you're trying to get at in that section.
Mr. Ealing.
Certainly, Senator Clausen. If could be replaced by when. The relationship that's trying to be established there is that there is an item we're defining as cloud data, and then we have to apply a trigger for when the government has access to it in order to make that data government data. And so that's the trigger that's being described right there. So if is not necessary, it could be replaced with another word.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ehling, you know, government, I think, as long as it's been around, has succeeded, or I shouldn't say succeeded, has executed backroom deals in order to facilitate certain things happening, in order to avoid public scrutiny. Our effort in this is trying to stem that so that we get greater public access. But I wonder, people are notoriously ingenious in their abilities to sidestep this. And I think one of the reasons why we're in this position is because the cloud has become such a popular method of information exchange. When this policy, let's say, has broad effect in the state of Minnesota, what can you expect would be the ways that ingenious individuals would try to avoid public scrutiny of their information exchange and actions? How would they do that in light of this policy?
Mr. Ehling.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. That is the evergreen question that we deal with as data requesters, and it's what led to the Amazon litigation in the first place, as one example. So the difficulty of option one, for instance, is that you are trying to provide a specific definition for a form of computer-based processes that are in common use. So anytime you're using words, you have the possibility that someone will come along and try to undercut or provide some subterfuge to make that word appear to be what it or to appear to be other than what you intended it to be. So that's the danger of definitions. So what we tried to do with option one is say, here's the best way we can define this cloud-based computing process. But then the reason why subdivision three is there is to say that, as with the general definition of government data in Chapter 13, there may be other options out there that this does not deal with. So let's, you know, option one is basically saying, let's define as best we can cloud-based processes, but say that there are other computer-based processes that would not be covered here. And those are essentially left to a later day for discussion. And that's been the case with the broad definition of government data. It is very, very broad. And over the course of time, there have been disputes over what it means or how it applies. A lot of those disputes are left to a later day if you have broad language. So option two, for instance, provides broader language as a way of saying, let's try to encompass computing-based processes in a general sense. So really it's up to one of those two poles or somewhere in between. And that's why we're open to continuing this discussion to try to find that best solution.
Well, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that answer, Mr. Ehling. I guess what I'm asking for is currently, you know, if a bunch of these people get in a room and talk about it orally, you know, is what it is, okay? But they're trying to make this easier on themselves by sharing data in a method that should be publicly accessible, we all agree. What I'm trying to figure out is what's after what's next. What are they going to do next to avoid that? So if they all, you know, project into a star chamber in the astral plane and have a little confab about it or whatever, there's nothing we can do about that. What's the next thing? Is there a method of technology that does not fall under data stored in a computer network or similar that would be a way for these folks to sidestep their accountability under this policy? I have no idea what that could be, and I'm wondering if you had any notions of what that could be.
I think that, Representative Lesh, I think the possibility you're describing is still out there. We may not know what it is yet. Option one, for instance, is an attempt to describe something that we do know is happening right now and is in broad use and is called into question by a district court opinion. So that's the reason for this whole discussion, really, is to try to draw a ring around what has been prescribed outside of the common understanding of government data, make sure it's incorporated. And there are going to be other battles down the line that we might not be able to anticipate yet.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Any further discussion? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going back again to my concern about subdivision 2 being too broad. And I've thought about, too, what you said, Representative Lucero, about how things used to happen before we had these computer systems. And I guess what my concern is more about the search terms that you're using, whether it's Westlaw, whether it's a county hospital, and they're accessing pharmaceutical information and searching drug interactions. Like, are all of those things going to be subject to data practices and just because they're contracting with a third party? And so I guess that's what I'm thinking about. It used to be that we just had books, and we would go, and our thought process for how we were going to research whatever cases we were going to find or whether a doctor was going to prescribe a certain medication, they would go to a physical book, and that wouldn't have been subject to data practices. Maybe the actual case that I found is. So that's what I'm more concerned about, is just sort of the thought process being subject to this.
And those scope issues, Representative Mueller, have come up, and we're committed to talking through them and trying to figure that out. That is the hardest piece, frankly, of trying to talk about digital data, because the scope issues become so big, whether you're talking about definitional issues or access issues. Those are legitimate issues for discussion.
Is there any other conversation regarding this subject? Mr. Ealing, we didn't spend a lot of time on option 2 that you have. Option 2, by what I can tell, defines the capability or definition of what government data should be under the use of the cloud. Am I correct in defining that correctly?
Senator Limmer, option 2 is an example of what broader language might look like. And rather than talking about cloud data specifically, this kind of gets towards what Representative Lesch is indicating, that there are other processes out there that would not fall within even the commonly understood definition of cloud data. How do we deal with those processes? And one option would be to talk about the government's use of computer capabilities that a third party provides them with. And so that's the idea that this gets to right here. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Ealing, does the use of the words computer capabilities, is that kind of limiting? Let's say that a government had a separate file that they didn't put on a computer, but they had it in paper form locked away in a file cabinet somewhere. Then that would not be subject to this definition.
Senator Limmer, it would not be subject to this definition, but it would be government data under the data practices definition, because they would be maintaining that data in a paper format.
All right. And I've never asked this, is that kind of an honor system? Something is on a hard-written form, and it's stuffed into a file cabinet. Maybe no one else knows about it, except maybe one or two people. And if there was a request, how would anyone ever enforce that if
Senator
it never
Limmer,
was offered?
That's an excellent question, and data requesters who have pursued this kind of line of inquiry by requesting government data over time have encountered this very issue. So you initially hope that the government entity is providing you with the responsive data you requested. At the data request stage, you have no ability to root around in their file cabinets, metaphorically speaking. You can ask for certain data. If they don't provide you what you think they have, you can go back and ask them to conduct a supplemental search, for instance. The only way that you're able to actually get inside the file cabinet is through the litigation process of 1308. Once you're able to depose individuals, if it ever got to that stage. So that's why that 1308 section is in the Data Practices Act.
Before we end, is there anyone in the audience who might represent the cloud or a company that works with the cloud? I don't see anyone rushing up to the front. It would be interesting to know if anyone has any access to those individuals, that we're going to have this discussion again in another month, and it would be helpful for the industry to come forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I don't believe the deep state will ever reveal themselves. but I do have a question about one more question, if I may.
Or the Russians.
That's right, the Ruskies. About the definition of cloud data, Mr. Ealing. Is computer and computer network defined in statute?
Mr. Ealing.
Not to my knowledge, but I would defer to others if they have other other information on that.
Okay, so,
Representative
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Ealing, if, and I don't think it's out of bounds to suggest that if 30 years from now our computing technology reverted to something other than silicon-based chips, would that be included under computer network, in your opinion?
Mr. Ealing.
Representative Lesch, that is a good question, and it gets back to the earlier discussion we had that what we're trying to do here is define something that we know now. That's a process that's in common use. Some of those other definitional issues may require clarification at a later stage. I would back up and further note that the weeds that we're all getting into now, which is just a matter of walking through the definition of anything, that's a problem that the crafters of the Data Practices Act tried to avoid at the beginning by setting out this broad definition of government data, rather than trying to run through all these subdivisions, or sub-definitions, I should say. The only reason why we're having this discussion now is that a district court has kind of disrupted that broad definition, and we've provided a couple options for how to remedy that. We'd be open to others too. There may be simpler ways to get at this right of access idea or similar ideas. So I would just urge everyone to keep on looking at additional language.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, Mr. Ealing. And I think the drafters of the Data Practices Act in the 70s did a great job because they considered these very things that were potentially in the future, and they didn't make it specific to the only technology that was there at the time, which was paper files, and I don't even know if they considered mainframes at that time. But I want us to think about that, especially in light of the fact that the data practices folks in this legislature have seemingly been reactive to stuff repeatedly for the last 10 years. And so I'd like to be as proactive as possible, because I do not think it's out of bounds whatsoever to suggest that 30 years from now, based upon the speed at which technology is developing, the exponential speed, that we could be exchanging data or sharing data on something we hadn't even conceived of at that point. So I think this body is the perfect body to think about that, and I appreciate your help in steering us in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? I see that one more individual wishes to speak regarding this particular subject area, cloud data. Would you identify yourself for the record? And we have one other witness to come forward after you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stacey Christensen. I'm the Director of the Data Practices Office. And thank you for some time to share just some high-level feedback today. Mr. Ealing and Minkoji shared their draft language, and I appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with them and to kind of pull all of the relevant stakeholders together. As we just saw in this discussion, the complexities of the Data Practices Act are there, and my office's intent is to always kind of minimize those complexities and try to provide feedback and assistance as we can. I'm working on some alternative options to the language that Minkoji and Mr. Ealing have talked about. I don't have fully fleshed out language yet, and I understand there's hesitation to amend the definition of government data. However, I'm working with that idea to amend government data to add a sentence, possibly, to the current definition, something along the lines of government data includes, and to get to that idea of the right of access concept granted by another person to a government entity. So kind of in a more simplistic way, as opposed to adding another section. In terms of just high-level feedback on the draft language, and I realize this is a work in progress, but based on the types of questions that we receive from both government and the public, option one potentially adds a layer of ambiguity and complexity that could be difficult to both interpret and implement. So given that this new section 13.16 doesn't classify data specifically, but define terms and provides for access, I go back to my kind of original idea of adding to the definition of government data to kind of keep it consistent with the current operation. Creating the new section also creates potential unintended consequences when applied to a fact pattern different than the Amazon bid scenario. So there are a variety of things we can think about in that way. Option two also presents new terminology that's not defined, and in the discussion that you all had kind of alluded to that, terms such as third-party and computer capabilities aren't defined. We do have a definition of person currently in the Data Practices Act, so that may be kind of a better use than third-party, which isn't defined. So I'm happy to continue to keep working with Minkoji and any other stakeholders and offering feedback, and I appreciate your time, and I will take any questions.
Are there any questions for this testifier? Ms. Christensen, I might suggest when you're going down the trail of government data includes, you're going to have to put in a lot of things after that statement. And if you don't put it in, then it gives people reason to play mischief with our data. And we've been round circle on this over the decades, and that's how we've arrived at the definitions that we do have. Because if you omit something after a long list, that gives the channel for someone to take advantage of it. And so just keep that in mind as you're ferreting through this subject matter.
And Mr. Chair, just to kind of give some bones to maybe what I'm talking about is I'm playing with the idea of language about government data includes data maintained by a person that is granted an express right of access to a government entity for the joint use or review of data. So it's not kind of listing what it might include, it's incorporating that right of access that the language options have tried to.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We have one more person on our list, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on this subject? You could come down to the front if you wished and speak after Mr. Heller. Mr. Heller, if you keep your comments directed toward the reaction to the proposal by Minnesota Coalition on Government Information that was just presented, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Chair Limmer and people on the Data Practice Advisory Committee. I have a handout here. I sent it digitally.
Right. We'll ask, or is it in our files?
Anyways, I just
we'll have someone pass that out.
I just copy you, John Leshen, and to John Leshen yourself, and then LCC. My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the twice exceptional people with print disabilities. Minnesota Statute 120B15 defined twice exceptional. And people with print disabilities, you find in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2004, or the IDEA Act of 2004, and the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. Come to testify specifically regarding government data today.
Could you lift that microphone up a little bit? Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to thank you that now you have these meetings in captioning. I think that's a great thing for transparency, to bring these meetings to this place over here. A couple other commissions are doing it during the interim. It's a good thing to provide captioning. Everyone can benefit from captioning. You'll find that coming from the Commission for Deaf Blind. They had a last year, they put it on their blog about how everybody can benefit from captioning. Getting back to subject matter regarding Minkoji and their documents specifically, when you talk about rights of access, we also, what the data practice law does not include is digital. And because many bills are being passed the legislature every year to mandate online, we need to consider ADAA of 2008 with guided supplemented aid and services for accessibility based on web content accessibility guidelines of 508. Minnesota Statute 16E03, Subdivision 9, explicitly expresses that for state agencies. However, now, since the legislature passed more governance for MNET to use the cloud, I think that's more even more relevant today about third-party contracts and how native formats can be electronic but image only. Again, if it's not searchable, how easy it is to define, by the way. We all know that we all use search engines every day to find things. And I think it's very relevant that if it's searchable, it can read out loud. And if we provide another sensory mean other than just seeing it, you're going to reach more of the communities that have processing issues or fluency, how to acquire the printed word. For instance, when they use the word electronic in his handout, think about digital. You could define that. Matt can raise his hand if he agrees with it. I spoke to him before. I'm not going to ask him to testify. He certainly can raise his hand, and so can Stacy. If they agree that digital accessibility is very relevant for people that use screen readers, I think also not only people that use screen readers but use search engines for analytical reasons. We all know if it ain't searchable, we still have to turn it into character recognition to analyze it, to evaluate it. So we can come here at the legislature and provide civic engagement about being creative, when we look ahead, what does digital mean? 508 refresh was last year required by the FCC that all phone manufacturers made sure that their software and hardware were compatible and usable to the internet and that they all read out loud. Once again, in 2005, United Nations says everyone has the right, quote, to understand, end quote. It's not that we can read anymore. Can you understand oral English, frankly? And I think if we want to reach the broadest audience, not be biased, consider how digital fits into this, including maybe putting digital into the Minnesota Constitution on a broader brush, because that way that will look at third parties, not state agencies. Again, because if they're storing it in electronic format and the native file is an image, well, then it's still electronic, but it's not fully accessible for the larger audience, including people that are blind and print disabled, FONA, the only two FONA in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. Regarding your documents today, which the document I gave you today is that the Data Practice Commission dated 2015-16, they held their handouts. If you flip the page over, specifically there's a area there from Jason. He's the attorney that wrote that bill specifically. So what happens, because I use the Adobe Reader, it will read it out loud. However, I'm going to read it out loud because this thing ain't working because I recorded it. So you can see how it reads it out loud. Specifically, if you get into the third full paragraph, it says this email fulfills item one. These same documents have been sent to the office of Representative Erickson and Senator Wiggins to fulfill item two. However, I cannot fulfill item three. The draft program developed by the office does not allow exporting PDFs with struck through and underscore that is readable with JAWS and will not be able to implement that functionality before the end of the session. So basically, we have a draft bill here that has struck through our language but hasn't been introduced on the floor yet, but it's not fully accessible for the public engagement. So the question is...
Mr. Hiller?
What?
Mr. Hiller, the document before us is not a bill.
It's
a suggestion... to consider policy by Minkoji. It's written on their, I believe, their stationery. We reprinted it as you see it, but I don't think it has the capability of having, it has the underscores on it as new language, but it's representational of what might be a bill in the future or some version thereof. Once we start doing that, then it would be available to the public. But right now we are having a public discussion, and anyone who's listening to this conversation could get a copy of this from our office. So I'm not really sure that you're absolutely correct that the public does not have access to that. They do have access to it.
Chair, it's called SC-55625.
That's a previous bill from earlier today and regarding unmanned aerial vehicles. We already did that. You weren't here at the time. I didn't see it, at least.
Just so you know, that one specifically is still a draft form as well. And because it's draft, it applies specifically to the handout I gave you today. So, again, until it gets introduced on the floor, bills don't become fully accessible. That's what I'm expressing. Matt's stuff is not a bill, but yours is a bill created by the advisor last month. It's stamped that way on the header. So just so you know, you're having hearings. Unless that bill was introduced on the floor, it does come fully accessible. They defunded the bill that John was on, the 1962 bill, which asked the legislature to make it more transparent and accessible for the public. They defunded it, and they moved it, which passed in a special session, but defunded and moved the working group about 2 years. So now we're going to have 2 years of unaccessibility, and this is just another example of trying to create transparency, but your own draft bills aren't fully accessible for everybody. That's it in a nutshell. And one last thing, frankly, I would suggest that the LCC subcommittee data practice would specifically state or provide the minutes expressed that I unofficially represent the twice exceptional, and that there's a link to the prior committee, which was much more advanced, but they had a sunset on it, that you link those two together, frankly, because I think as we continue discussion on data practice, the LCC probably, I would feel like they'd have an obligation to connect that committee, which is an inactive committee, and this is an active committee, so people can go back and forth, understand, as we look at that single list that you created, one that's inactive. So we're kind of tracking that, or how you're choosing, you know, how you choose your agenda. Obviously, I still say if minute has to cloud, I think this is would be added into the list somehow to one of your agendas from the initial sunrise on that, the Data Practice Commission initially, not on this one, but that's my suggestion. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak, and I appreciate it. Anyone has any questions, you can certainly ask them again, but that's all I have to say for today.
Does anyone have any questions for this testifier? Hearing none, this meeting is coming to a close. We stand adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Heller.